Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
The Men's Room podcast from TalkSport is proudly sponsored by Toolstation. If, like me, you love a little deal, then you can join the Toolstation Club today online, in-store or via the app, and you will save some money getting a 5% discount shopping with Toolstation, as well as a chance to get your hands on some fantastic prizes, such as TVs, gaming consoles, and even holidays. If you keep spending, you'll keep on saving. That's the Toolstation Club. So make sure you join today, online, in-store, or via the app. A Bosch.
Hello everyone, I'm Adi Oladipo and welcome once again to the Men's Room where we discuss everything men. Today, we're going to discuss anxiety. I'm joined as always by my sidekick, Mr. Rory Jennings. How are you, Rory? Good?
Yeah, I was better until I was referred to as a sidekick.
It works, doesn't it now?
Yeah,
it works. I'm a sidekick on your YouTube channel. You're a sidekick to me on the Men's Room podcast.
It's a power play.
Okay. Once you sit in the green chair, you've got all the power, as you know. We're also joined by psychotherapist, author, and podcaster Joshua Fletcher. Josh, how are you, my man?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
This is an interesting topic because I think it's going to go to so many different spaces and places. Anxiety, describe it. What does it mean?
It's a word that covers a lot, really. One person's anxiety is not the same as someone else's. A really helpful distinction that I like to make is you split anxiety into two. Mm. You've got your conventional anxiety, which is I'm worried about my job interview, an exam, a first date, a medical test, whatever, anxiety that everyone can relate to.
Yeah.
But then you've got the other side of anxiety that needs more attention to being brought to it, a bit like what we're doing today. And this is the inwards kind of disordered anxiety stuff. So this is when we have panic attacks, struggle with intrusive thoughts, when we avoid doing stuff, when we constantly ruminate, our days are dictated by what if thoughts, I should thoughts, and we have strange symptoms, heart palpitations, dissociation, really, really sticky anxiety. So when one person says, I'm struggling with anxiety, for me as a therapist and someone who's been there as well, I was diagnosed with severe anxiety years ago. I'd want to know, well, what kind of anxiety are you struggling with? And I'll talk about that today.
It's good that he split it in two, isn't it? Because I think the first one we all go through.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, whether or not we, even before we go on air, a bit nervous because you're going to go on air. So you feel like that level of anxiety just in life in general.
And that can be good. That kind of anxiety, I think, can be beneficial. Because certainly when I was sitting my exams, it was the fear of not doing well in them that inspired me to try and do well in them. It's the fear of it going wrong that kind of inspired me to try and make it go right.
Yeah.
So it can be quite focusing. That kind of anxiety, as you mentioned there, nervous of a date, nervous of an exam. For me, I just define that as life. That's just part of the process of living. Yeah, you're nervous about particular events, but that's part of the rich tapestry of life. The other side of anxiety that you touched on there, well, that's terrifying. That's very different, I think. And I would probably be wrong here, Josh, and I'm very happy to be, and used to being, in fact. But you know the first kind that you referred to, going on a date? Is that not just life? That isn't anxiety. That is just your everyday life.
Absolutely. You're right. It can be a positive emotion, and it's been proven to be a performance enhancing part of your body, mind and body. If you're, the World Athletics are on at the moment. If you're about to do the 100 meters, you want to be anxious because you've got more adrenaline, more cortisol. You're going to be, your muscles are going to use that. It's performance enhancing. It's to an extent as well, psychologically. When I remember doing my exams and caring a lot So I would read the question twice because I'm a bit anxious. I'd read over my answers. I'm not just sat there half asleep, you know, trying to get through it. It can be helpful. Where it becomes difficult, and I use the word disorder because I like its literal meaning. I'm not just trying to diagnose everyone. Disorders isn't not in the right place. So you know you're struggling with anxiety when you're sat in a place where you're having that threat response, because that's what it is, it's a threat response, I'm afraid of threat. You're having that threat response in a place that there is no threat. There's no threat there. And then you start to worry, well, why am I so anxious all of a sudden? Then, this is where it can get really sticky, your imaginative brain, your thought brain, wants to try and help you. And that's when anxiety can get really, really fruity, because then you start getting images and imaginations. You start playing out worst case scenarios.
I've heard about this. There's some. Is it called catastrophizing?
Yeah,
it's called catastrophizing, isn't it? Where something small happens, and then your brain goes, "Okay, well, this is what could happen if everything went as wrong as it possibly could. This is what could happen." And you end up trying to process that, which is effectively an imaginary catastrophe that is almost definitely not going to happen. But that is what you are trying to process.
Yeah, definitely. And you must remember, anxiety is literally your threat response. And it has never, ever evolved from our ancestors when they were mooching about through the jungle, Serengeti, wherever. That part of the brain, which is part of our limbic system, I just call it the threat response for simplistic purposes, is it's never evolved. It's the fastest, but also the kind of stupidest part of our brain as well. And it's there just in case we're in danger. And you're right, 99.9% of the time we're not in danger, but just in case. That's why you jump when your friend jumps out, you know, there's a part of you that's like, just in case, you know. Have you ever nodded off? You must have had this where you've tried to nod off to sleep and then you've dreamt that you've like tripped over a curb or something just in case.
Yeah, fall off a building quite regularly, and I wake up as if I've fallen. I kind of go, "Am I? No, I'm okay."
Well, that's your threat response, just in case you're falling off a building. Yeah, you're like, "Well, I'm not. I'm in my bed." And it, depending on what the threat is where people struggle with their anxiety. So if you struggle with social anxiety and you're shy, other people's judgments threat. If you struggle with panic attacks, then panic itself is the threat. If you struggle with catastrophizing, then any situation could be the threat. And what I do as a therapist and an anxiety expert is I like to break down where is your anxiety giving you trouble and how does it apply to you.
Why does it consume so many people? Like you mentioned athletics there, for example, the World Championships are on right now. And there used to be a guy that used to run called Asif Appal. You probably know of him. Unbelievable. When there wasn't much on the line, this guy would beat everyone. Run almost world record times all the time. Every time he got to the Olympics or World Championships, it would just, you could see it. You could see him at the start line almost just having almost a mini panic attack. And he would never, ever do his best. And ultimately, his career has been defined by him not being able to produce on the big stages. And I feel like that anxiety, which everyone obviously has in that start line, but obviously they use it to their positive. He uses it as a negative and it just completely ruins him.
He's the Harry Kane of athletics.
Never delivers in the big ones.
Exactly.
Never delivers. Wait, why are some people like that?
You'd have to, I mean, I can only speculate here. And obviously, if we're speculating, Asif Appal might, on the big stage, when it matters the most, he might have more anxiety, more, it means probably the pressure that's on him is added, and that kind of, you see that in all sports. I'd love to ask him, you know, what was going through his mind there. I've worked with kind of many sports professionals, and each person has their own kind of reasoning, but a common one I hear is actually when people make their entire self-esteem, their entire value on that moment, it's counterproductive. You know, Asif Appal is a human being. He's probably got loads of strings to his bow, but I can't imagine the whole athletics world telling him this, telling him that, what's going on. Also, you've got to remember the kind of genetics plays a part as well. The stuff that it's not in our control. You know, if you've got an anxious mum or dad, or you've noticed that anxiety's gone through the family, you're going to inherit those genetics as well. So your body might be releasing more anxiety than the guy next to you. So yeah, there's many factors in there. And to be honest, there's someone, you know, I find it fascinating. I'd love the chance to ask him, to be honest.
What's going through your head?
Yeah.
I think it is really interesting, because, you know, if you keep it in a sporting context, which I certainly like to do because I find it very relatable, Didier Drogba constantly turning up when it really mattered. That's more than luck, isn't it? That's more than the right place at the right time.
Sporting ability.
That is something that separates him mentally from his counterparts.
Yeah.
Didier Drogba, you know, if you score in one final, cool. If you score in two, decent. Three, you're a pretty good player. 11.
Yeah, there must be tests that can be done to show that when he has these stress levels, he seems to just. He's normal. His heart rate doesn't go up.
Or it does normal. Massively, but he uses it the correct way. Mm. I think you know, the occasion when you walk out and the Champions League music's playing and you're playing against Munich in Munich, it's massive. Maybe he could use that and use it as a positive. And maybe all of those, you know, those sportsmen that really do reach the zenith of their game.
Mm.
And, you know, the people that are icons forever, Michael Jordan, Cristiano Ronaldo, Lionel Messi. Maybe that is part of it, having the ability to use those pressured situations when not only is it up to you to try and win, but people kind of expect it of you. Your teammates are looking for you. It's not only your fans. The other fellas on the pitch who share the responsibility, they're looking at you.
Mm.
To be able to use that as a positive is a very particular skill. And I honestly think it's mental. It can't be.
Yeah, because they've all of them on that pitch
have skills.
World-class
have skills,
players,
exactly.
So it must be something mental that separates them.
Exactly.
And you're right, they use the anxiety in a good way, and they don't let it consume them. I remember when I had my own sort of issues of anxiety where I used to think the world's going to come to an end. Like, oh, that's it. Like the smallest thing that you guys have just mentioned, I used to think I'd blow that up into the biggest thing. And I remember the only way I could get through it was by thinking, okay, this is not death or jail. I know it sounds extreme, but like, I'm not going to die and I'm not going to jail. And that's the only way I'd get through whatever I was making into the biggest thing in the world.
Mm.
And that was my own way of getting through it, thinking, okay, no one's killing you and you're not going to go to jail. So and I used to think, what's the worst thing that could happen? And those were the two
biggest
things.
But that's probably quite good, isn't it? Like, in terms of coming up with a solution to your own problem, whatever you've got, would this be good advice? Whatever you've got to say to keep moving forward.
Yeah, these are what's the worst thing that can happen?
Yeah.
And for me, the worst two things were, I'm going to go jail or die. Okay, it's not those two then.
Yes. Right,
we're survivable then.
We're right, aren't we?
You know, we're going to get through it. That's my own way of doing it.
Well, that's a coping strategy, and it's okay. I mean, I'm a Newcastle fan and I've watched them since I was younger. And, you know,
it's not going to help the anxiety.
I remember being at the Etihad, because my partner is a huge City fan, and we were sat behind the goal and watching Aguero score his fifth.
Yeah.
I was like, well, at least my teeth aren't being removed. So you could use that as a coping strategy.
Start Googling how Sunderland are getting on. Well, at least they're losing. Yeah.
But it depends what it is, because like in some situations, well, the worst case scenario here is that I could die. Well, I don't want to die. It depends. For me, I always teach the philosophy of leaning into uncertainty. The uncertainty is the skill, and this could actually relate to what we were talking about before, is like, how good are you at tolerating that uncertainty that is hovering over you? Maybe indeed your Drogba is like, I'm all right with the uncertainty with being there, whereas Asafa Powell might be like, you know, this mass amounts of uncertainty is actually affecting my performance. All anxiety, and particularly disordered anxiety, what we're talking about, is about our relationship with uncertainty. I was someone who was diagnosed with OCD, an actual diagnosis. OCD is not an adjective, you know, to describe cleanliness or whatever. It's a crippling anxiety disorder for many. And I just wanted certainty that all those horrible thoughts, like you know, you could relate to Adi, you know, is the world going to end? You know, I needed certainty that it wouldn't happen. I needed certainty that I wouldn't, you know, freak out in public, or I wouldn't get bullied at school, or I needed certainty that Aguero wouldn't do that to me again.
Did you, you know, when you just said there that you public going, you know, having a sort of public issue, did anything ever happen like that? You know, when you were at your, when you were struggling at the lowest point, did anything ever happen? And if it did, how did people react? Like, do you think there is a stigma still there?
Yeah, I mean, I was struggled. The reason I became a therapist was, I had a panic attack at work, and I'd never known what a panic attack was. I'd never really used the word anxiety before. I just thought it meant, you know, worried about exams. And at the time, you know, I was working in a school with excluded kids in Bolton, and there was lots of stuff happening at home, as well as looking after my brother, who was very poorly, and my stress was just going up and up and up and up, and I was ignoring it, not doing the right things, smoking cannabis to self-medicate, maybe having a few beers or whatnot, and which is, you know, each to their own, but in the situation I was in, it perhaps wasn't great. And then one day I just woke up feeling like quite hyper, and I was like, I never wake up feeling awake. I'm like, that's odd. And I must have had 3 hours sleep. I got the bus to work, started making a cup of tea, and as I was stirring the tea bag, I just felt suddenly like, whoa, I don't feel like I'm here. I felt like I was in the Matrix. I felt like, you've seen Men in Black, that scene where they open up that guy's head and there's a little alien inside it. That's what it felt like. I could feel myself, hear myself talking. People looked like clay. I was like, I've done it. I've lost my mind. I've finally done it. You know. But what was actually happening is I'm having a panic attack where my threat response had decided to use a month's worth of chemicals and just go bam. And I was like, whoa, what's going on here? It was describing it like a high that I didn't do. There was no explanation for it. And I was terrified. And I actually got my mum to pick me up. And I went home and I tried to work it out. I had these strange symptoms. My hands didn't look like mine. I was hyperventilating, sweating. I was like, what have I done here? I was trying to work out what was going on. And I was in my room, didn't leave my house for about 3 months. I was really quite poorly. And then what really helped was just someone explaining to me what on earth was going on. I was like, I can't be a panic attack.
You didn't leave your room for 3 months?
I couldn't even. I would be terrified to go and use the toilet. And bear in mind, I was a confident person before it as well. I'd do stand-up comedy, play music. I did drama. It caught me off guard. Catch anyone off guard. And then I learned about it, and through certain things, my doctor didn't actually help. My medication just made me feel more anxious because I was just constantly wondering when the medication was going to work or whatever. Anyway, I learned a lot about it, psychoeducation, what's happening in my mind, my body, what's going on. And I realized, actually, I'm quite normal. This is okay. This is something that happens around this time. And I was so passionate about it, I started writing my books about it and doing what I do.
When you say around this time, what do you mean? Like, you can sense triggers?
So the stats tell you that, like, panic attacks like that, and anxiety disorders mostly happen between the ages of 16 and young 30s. And I was like 22, 23 at the time. This wasn't explained to me, though. The information wasn't there for me at the time, and that's why I love doing things like this, because, you know, if someone's listening, watching now, and you're like, whoa, that describes me, it's like, you know,
you're going to be sweet, mate.
You're all right. Yeah. You know, I know it feels like there's a gun to your head and whatever, but you're all right. It's strange to get your head around that you're not actually in danger. You just feel like you're in danger.
I just wonder if people are listening to this and they're almost trying to self-diagnose, how they separate sort of being in sort of anxiety one that we mentioned, which is your everyday stresses of life, and what you went through in two. A lot of people would just assume that it's one, and just kind of, you know, I think we spoke about this last week, just roll your sleeves up. It's only that. It's just part of life. And whether or not, okay, it's got to the point where it's serious, because you mentioned as well for yourself where, you know, your stress levels are going up, but you're still just going to work. It was just keep on going, keep on moving. And I just wonder if people are going to think that, like, okay, no, it's okay. This is it. We're okay. You know, We just got to keep on going to the point where you just hit a wall, like you hit. And it's almost, how do people not hit that wall? When do they realize, okay, this is a bit more than just level one?
That's a really good question. The best way to do it is to, you know, you're struggling with horrible, excessive anxiety when your days are dictated by a feeling of doom, dread, loads of what if thoughts. We all have what if thoughts. They're okay, you know, but I mean, when it's just constant, catastrophic what if thoughts, you don't feel like yourself. You don't feel like your old you. You're turning down things that you wouldn't usually turn down. Maybe it's, you know, you're playing golf with your mates or going for drinks or whatever, and you start to withdraw. This can be anxiety as well as depression. It gets often misinterpreted. Anxiety gets misinterpreted as depression quite a lot. And you just constantly feel the sense of fear. Then you don't really tell anyone because, you know, I don't live in a dream world. There's still a massive taboo around it. Not that your friends wouldn't care, but also there's a taboo around just having the conversation and sitting in the awkward silence of your friend not knowing what to say. It's not their fault. It's just the fabric of communication hasn't been woven yet. That's when you're in two, disordered anxiety there. And you might be, your diet will go, your sleep's rubbish, you're having strange symptoms, palpitations, you're obsessed with how you feel. That's one of the big ones. I was obsessed with how I felt. I went from not really caring how I felt to all my attention inwards.
And what do you mean emotionally, not physically?
Both.
Right.
Yeah, or is the anxiety there yet? Is my heart beating normally? Stuff like that. And I was never really having any attention on the self to having suddenly all the attention on the self. Even sometimes, do I feel sad? Does that mean I'm going to get depressed? Am I going to lose control? It's just constant rumination. That's when you need to kind of get some help for it.
Yeah, I think it's so important to differentiate, as you said there, because I mean, when you and I have discussed these kind of things in the past, I've generally adopted quite a stern approach. For example, you know, keep going, pull yourself together, that kind of attitude. But that would only be applicable to the first kind that we're talking about. This second kind is illness. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, you can, illness, it's things aren't right, things need to be put back in place. It's like, if you can apply the attitude of keep going, and I don't, you know, there's a place for that, definitely. Sometimes when I'm like, if I'm doing a talk and I'm really anxious, I'll psych myself up. I'm like, come on, you can do this, and get on with it.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
You're brave. And that's fine, absolutely. But no, disordered anxiety, you're on a loop. And if you're only saying, come on, get on with it, pull your sleeves up, you're just increasing the speed of that hamster wheel that you're on. You're not going anywhere.
It's funny because in this industry, which is still quite new to me, it's quite new to you, to be fair, since we've been doing this, I've been a broadcaster for 5 years, and I still have, I'm still, especially when I get something new, like, oh, Ade, we want you to do this. I'm like, whoa, bit out of my comfort zone, this one. And I definitely get stress levels. And they go through the roof, like literally go through the roof. I remember talking to my mum about this, and I was like, I feel like I shouldn't be as nervous now because I've been doing it 5 years, but I could be doing anything and I get really, really nervous to the point where my mum, who, bless her, she's very, very like Bible orientated, like a Bible basher, definitely. And she gave me a Bible passage to read, like before anything, before any big gig, I've got a Bible passage that I read. And that then brings it down a little bit. Now, honestly, that brings that stress level down a bit. But I just wonder if that's almost crossing over slightly to two, or is that just one still where it's just part and parcel of nervous? It's just another gig, or am I sort of verging on two where it's like, I'm too stressed out about these gigs. I've been doing them for years. I should be okay now.
I mean, not to turn into your therapist, but I think...
No, feel free.
I also know what that Bible passage is. There's a... You could say you're on one foot in either. It's okay. I mean, the first thing I say to people when they've got anxiety around the job and stuff is that if you're not nervous, you don't care. I mean, you know, you're nervous because you care. Maybe it's a result of you putting a lot of pressure on yourself, perfectionism, can I do it, can I pull it off? But also at the same time, you know, you're using that, it's okay. You've got coping strategies in there. I think it's really lovely that, you know, you've got a supportive parent. It's like, you know, you can do that. And you're getting through it every time. You know, if you started to turn down work, if you started to do all these things, then you'd be more in in two. But you know, I think you know that you're going to do
also,
it.
So, Addy, it would be wild for you, considering the pressure that is on some of the jobs that you do.
Yeah.
Like, you know, hosting a sporting show with a co-host as somebody like Tony Bellew, who is famous and an idol of yours. You know, you've been a boxing devotee all your life. You've supported and watched Tony Bellew. Suddenly you're on next a par to, with Tony right. Bellew, and you're the broadcaster. You're responsible for that, ultimately, even though he's the authority. It's on you. You've got the director in your ear. He's Tony Bellew. He hasn't really got the pressure. It is you carrying the show. It would be wild for you to not feel anxious going into that. It'd be wild for you to not have butterflies. Mm. But that's kind of going back to what I meant before, where they can be inspiring. But I think Josh has hit the nail on the head very early in this pod. Butterflies aren't OCD. Do you know what I mean? Like, what you're talking about is certainly in the realm of normality. Whereas, as Josh said there, if you started saying, okay, I'm not going to do that job, I'm going to turn down the opportunity, then we would have to have a serious conversation. Yeah.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
The Men's Room podcast on TalkSport is proudly sponsored by Toolstation. This is your little reminder that you can join the Toolstation Club today online, in-store, or via the app. You might be thinking, why would I sign up? But I'm glad you asked. At Toolstation, if you keep spending, you keep on saving. Signing up means that not only will you get a lovely 5% discount shopping with Toolstation, but there are thousands of prizes to be won. So that's the Toolstation Club. So make sure you join today online, in-store, or via the app.
Is there more men suffering from anxiety than women? Or is it
always
just
portrayed as a man thing, isn't it? It's always portrayed as a man thing.
It's down the line. It's a human condition.
Yeah.
The only thing that changes is our conditioning as men.
I'm so surprised you've said that.
Oh, absolutely. No, but think about it. Here's a word to show off at parties. It's called interjections. It's my favourite word.
I need a few of these. Addy, write it down. Addy, one day you'll get invited to a party. Yeah. You can use it.
Yeah, use that one.
This is what I talk about a lot, particularly with males. No, we're more susceptible, and but any gender susceptible to anxiety. It's a human thing. With kind of women older in life, with the hormonal changes like the menopause and things like that, they're perhaps more susceptible to an anxiety disorder later on. But in general, anxiety affects everyone. Men definitely suppress it more because of something I like to call an introjection. An introjection is when we absorb a belief system from growing up, and I have done a lot of work on picking mine as a man. I like being a man. I like certain elements of masculinity. There's some elements of masculinity I can't stand, and they weren't helpful for me. But we are a result of these introjected beliefs. So, for example, I always use my own. My grandma's died at the funeral. And I'm crying because that's a healthy biological mechanism that our brain has to help us process grief. Something horrendous has happened. Crying's like normal, you know, it should be normalized. And as I'm crying because I'm never going to see my grandma again, my uncle leans over, authoritative male, puts his hand on my shoulder and says, "Don't cry, be strong for your grandma." Now, I've interjected a belief that strength equates to holding in my emotions, and also I'm not getting the kind of approval from males. And yet, he's holding back the tears himself. But for some reason, there's a reverence in the emotional conservatism of not showing your emotions, which is great in world wars. Mm. You've not got time for that kind of thing. You know, like, hunker down, we're about to die. But now, I mean, that emotional conservatism is one of the biggest problems that, in my professional opinion, that we have. It's the contributor to why the biggest killer of men under 50 is suicide, because men, that reverence of putting on a display and showing that you've got everything in order is so strong that it comes at the risk of actually showing that, you know... That
I wonder if that's generational, though. I think that's a very poignant and powerful story, but I think I conform to a lot of the stereotypes that go along with your uncle in this story.
Yeah.
Like, I think I conform to those, but not this particular one. So I would... I mean, I hope this doesn't come around for a long time, but when the day comes where my grandmother passes, I will be a wreck, and I won't apologize for that, and I know that that will be the case, and that's definitely how I will process that. I feel like perhaps there has been a shift, maybe generationally, where tears and emotion and open emotional honesty isn't frowned upon the way it once was. I feel like there are lots of other issues, but I'd like to think that we've moved on a little bit from that. Big boys don't cry, I think, is outdated, or at least is becoming outdated.
It's starting to shift, but I would say it's nowhere near.
Really?
I see it in my own friendship groups. I'm one of the leading therapists for anxiety disorders, and my own mates that I grew up with, they wouldn't open up to me.
Right.
The power dynamic, I'm a threat. Because of who I am, it's interesting. My female friends, very happy to open up. The men know, because it is, and I don't care what anyone says, we have internalized prejudices that it is weakness, and we can have the platitudes in that. But if I were to really ask most guys, say, would you stand in front of your mates and start crying? Deep down, they'd be like, no. They'd do it performatively. So if it was for, say, I don't know, something like this or whatever, I think they would. But deep down with your mates, no one watching,
no, I agree.
They wouldn't do it.
I think that's why the Paddy Pimblett sort of clip has gone so far, because it doesn't happen. If that was an everyday occurrence,
and he's a fighter,
yeah, and he's a fighter,
and he's
right?
Fighter.
So he's like, as
he's double hard, he's just walloped someone in a ring,
like someone, yeah. And all of a sudden he's showing emotion. It's like, but because that doesn't happen, I think that's why that clip's gone so crazy.
Yeah,
similar absolutely. To when Tyson Fury sort of spoke about mental health and stress, because we don't see that. That's why it's so. I think if you see it every day, then it wouldn't.
Well, you're starting to see it in sports now a lot. I mean, it was at Simona Halep, one of the best tennis players. Mm. She had a panic attack on court. Mm. And she's just, you know, steely, professional, like a machine of a tennis player. And, yeah, you see it a lot. Stephen Reed.
Yeah, played for Blackburn, didn't he? Ireland international. Island,
yeah. He's come out and he struggled a lot with anxiety, things like that. Mm.
Tyrone Mings recently said something.
Mm.
I think it is. But you see, that kind of pressure, particularly elite level sports people, I do get it. I do understand, like, the pressures, because if nothing else, it's 25,000 people every week on Tyrone Mings' case. Do you know what I mean? Like, if nothing else, it's the home support, which is more than 25,000 at Villa or whatever.
Michael Johnson was talking about this recently at the World Athletics Championship.
The former Man City player.
No, the other
forgot
one.
Forgot about him. Yeah, yeah.
He's an estate agent now, by the way. Estate agent. Doing all right for himself. Yeah. But he was, Dina Asher-Smith, one of the athletes, was talking about her struggles that she's gone through in the last sort of 3 or 4 months, her grandma dying, who she was very close with. And Michael Johnson said, this is interesting, because before, athletes, if you lose, you lose. You're almost not allowed to give an excuse as to why I came fifth or sixth. Mm. Like, if you just came fifth, you'd walk away, there'd be no interview. And now, he said, it's a new generation that he loves. You can tell your backstory, what happened, as to why maybe you're not performing. Because I think we look at these athletes as robots. So when they don't perform, we just laugh. Mm. When we don't really know what's going on. And a lot of them are suffering through a lot of stress and anxiety.
But this is why it's important, that going back to the word introjection, imagine this scenario. Like, if you interjections start from even before you're born, baby showers, boy blues, you know, boy is blue, girl is pink. Like, where was that written? You know, like, who decided that? You know, kind of, I actually quite like the color pink. But, you know, when I was walking around a festival with a pink shirt on the other day, like, you know, it's those kind of things. But what you interject, imagine coming home from school and your mum and dad don't even turn around and say hello to you, or but then your sister walks in and she's got a medal, you know, sporting achievement, and they put it on the fridge. You know, what are you interjecting from that? Well, to be good at sports gives you value, and that you're not as lovable as your sister.
Yeah.
What about when you're walking around and seeing, like, you're seeing, like, lad culture, don't you? It's just lots of, you know, like, kind of
geezers,
stuff like that. Which is fun. Like, don't get me wrong, I like messing around with my mates and stuff, but lots of it is performative. It's learned, it's copied. It's like, maybe that's what it is to be a guy, and things like that. And with sports people, it must be enormous, because the pressure that's on you from as a kid. I mean, if you want to be that one of the best tennis players, you've got to start playing when you're five.
Absolutely.
And
you've got to be the best in your area, but, in your country.
So the Williams sisters are the model here, aren't they?
Yeah.
You know, they were cultivated into being.
Mm.
What a life, what a career. What a, like, it's not only bad, is it? It's important to acknowledge that being brilliant and rising to the very top, the way that they have by dedicating their life to something via a pushy father, it's not only bad. It's, what's the alternative if they're not tennis players?
Mm.
They've lived an amazing life.
Mm.
They're mentioned in a Snoop song. I love that.
Yeah,
it's not only bad, is it, or is it?
Well, it depends if they like that kind of stuff. Like, it's like, where's the? You've
got to love being a Wimbledon champ, haven't you? Got to.
Possibly,
I'd imagine so. But who was the tennis player that just completely quit at 23?
Yeah, Martina Hingis, wasn't it? Didn't Martina Hingis quit?
I think it was from last year. It was the Wimbledon,
champion who now plays golf.
Yeah,
I'm done now.
Yeah, I'm done. 24. I'm just, everyone's like, what?
Yeah. She's gone, I've been doing it.
So broke.
I've been doing this for 2 decades.
Yeah, just like, I'm out of here.
Yeah. I love that. I was like, she's like, no, done now.
I find it fascinating that she did that, and almost like, good.
Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? It's not only bad.
No, it's certainly not. There will always be some resentment from these superstar athletes that
you're resenting it from your Miami mansion and with your Wimbledon trophy.
You're also looking at it though from that they're the exception to the rule.
Yeah,
only one person gets to be champion.
Yeah,
and the hundreds and thousands of people who have the same pushy parents are not champion.
Yeah.
They're not in a Snoop Dogg video.
Yeah,
and they're going to feel like failures. And I think that's why you get a lot of sports people, particularly at the end of their careers. If you look at rugby, particularly
rugby, isn't it? Yeah, I saw some data on that.
Football.
Yeah, cricket as well. Have you seen the data for cricket? Basically, people when fellas finish playing cricket, and I've only seen the fellas data. It may be applicable to the girls as well. But when fellas finish playing cricket, the drop off in terms of mental health and whatever is huge, because I think you go from play cricket in only lovely locations, right? You go from touring the world to being part of a team to suddenly potentially having to learn a trade or whatever, and a lot of people struggle to cope with that. There is an issue in cricket.
Yeah, and if you're not a champion, you don't have the legacy to fall back on and stuff. So yeah, if you take that example, it's great. You know, what does it take to be the best? Yeah, you're right. So it would have to take that, but at the same time, it comes with it at a cost. I find, and you do see it. I mean, I believe like kind of chronic anxiety and disordered anxiety comes from, I use the example of a stress jug. It's not original. It's just, but it's something I like to use. And it's, you know, we all have the ability to tolerate stress, in a jug or a cup. The size of that cup is dependent on genetics. So my mum and dad are quite anxious, so my cup's going to be quite small. So I've got to be very careful what stress goes in there. Mm. If you think about stress that goes in there, you've got like money, relationships, career, pandemics, things like that, and it starts to go up, and then throw in a bit of grief in there, a bit of traumatic events, a bit of whatever, and suddenly overflows. And at that moment it overflows, it's the moment you start experiencing panic attacks.
How do you, I'm going to cut across you, how do you stop it?
You don't.
From overflowing.
Oh, like, overflowing.
What, how do you...
Preventative, brilliant. This is what I tried. First of all, you've got to identify what's in there. Like, I've sat with guys in my therapy room, and it's taken ages for them to actually have a look in, because they just put the lid on. They're like, I'm not bothered. I'm a guy. I can handle it. I'm hard. You know, it's like, all right, well, good luck with that one, mate.
I'm hard.
I have a mate who's, and I'll be very candid here. I've had a mate who I grew up with, and he has that kind of mindset, and he is quite hard actually. But anyway, but he lost his dad, and naturally, I was like, you know, you want to talk about? I lost my dad, man. It was heartbreaking. He was like, I'm all right. And then he suddenly goes into boxing to has an outlook, which is fair enough, whatever. And then he goes into heavy drinking, abusing drugs. And all. I was like, you could just talk about this, you know. And it took him. The biggest thing was lifting up what was in there. And he actually, ended up going to therapy and stuff like that. But not only did he find that the grief of his father was in there, there's loads of other stuff that was in there. He's just buried. He's absolutely buried. That's why some people can handle grief better than others, because for some people, grief is what makes the jug overflow. Mm. And for some people, they've got more resources in there. Mm. You know, whereas, and for me, it was grief that made my jug overflow. There was already stuff going on in my head. So yeah, it's about looking what's in there, because don't expect to turn up to the therapy room with all the answers. When you say it's okay to talk, it's okay to explore. What's going on there?
It's funny. Like I remember when no job, no money. We've all been through this, where like there is no money. So I remember the letters coming through the door, and I knew what those letters were. I knew it was either bailiff, bills, and in my head I'm thinking, I have no money, and my stress levels are crazy. I can't open that because I'm not going to open it.
It's not going to be a birthday card, is it?
Just leave the door closed.
Honestly, dude,
yeah.
Literally. So,
yeah. I'm going to order a pizza instead.
I just knew. I couldn't afford the pizza.
Yeah.
But I knew exactly what the bailiff letter looked like. You know, I knew. And it got to a point where I did do what you said, and I just opened them. Like, I remember it was a big thing for me. Like, all right, what can we do? We can't hide through the curtain every time you hear someone approach your door thinking it's a bailiff. So I just opened them. And eventually, you know, I started calling the bailiffs, started to get arrangements, started to, you know, set up direct debits, even if it was a minimum amount. And it was very...
I love that analogy. Yeah. That's the perfect analogy.
That was the way, the way. I just remember the letters coming.
Yeah, and processing a problem is the road to solving the problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
A bit at a time as well. People think that when you go to therapy or when you're going through financial issues, you know, you just one letter at a time. One bit at a time. So I do in therapy. Not like you don't have to unleash everything.
No.
When people go to therapy about anxiety or disordered anxiety, conventional anxiety, just general worries, that's okay, depression, whatever, you don't need to just splurge it all out. Mm. Be like, you don't have to talk about any of it. Mm. Just get to know me, feel comfortable, and then we'll talk about it. Yeah. But yeah, one at a time. I really like that analogy.
We've actually got a listener question here, Josh, if you wouldn't mind just hearing it. It says, my anxiety is most difficult to manage at night. I lay in bed and the silence is hard to deal with. My mind runs away with me and I never get a good night's sleep. What should I do?
So this is a rumination problem. This is life-changing for me. I was the same. I always be afraid to go to bed because the association with bed is lying there feeling anxious. Rumination is when our attention goes inwards. I call it the rumination roller coaster. What if this happens? Well, I'll play it out in my head, and what if that happens? And then I'll try and problem solve that thing happening, even though it probably won't happen. Mm. And going round and round and round. Rumination is actually behavior. It's not just you thinking, it's a behavior. You are behaving. You are ruminating. Someone with OCD, I've got to watch out for rumination because that's one of my biggest compulsions. Just like someone with OCD may wash their hands or excessively tidy, my compulsion is to sit and just ruminate. And you can tell because I'm sat in a room and I'm just there.
Mm. It's all going on in your head.
It's all going on in my head, yet ruminate, and that's what's happening. What you can do, and your advice for you there is that, and I probably get this, people who ruminate in bed often keep themselves distracted in the day. You've probably got to-do lists this big. You don't sit by yourself. My advice to you is obviously, you know, CBT therapy is great for things like that and go to therapists or whatever. But if that isn't for you, practice allowing yourself to have sit with rumination throughout the day, but detaching from it. So, because you can't stop your mind, you can't stop thoughts. That's the number one rule in psychology. You can't stop thoughts, but you can choose to observe them and focus on other things. When I was struggling with OCD, but then recovering, I was like, oh, I've noticed I'm ruminating now. I'm noticing the what ifs. What would I usually be doing right now? I don't know. I was crack on the PlayStation and lose to the easiest level on FIFA. I don't know. At bed, obviously, it's difficult because you want to be sleeping. So practice in the day of sitting with that rumination, because you're probably avoiding it all day. And then you lie in bed and it's hitting you like a train, and then it's releasing adrenaline and cortisol. Also, just make it easier. I love listening to stuff like audiobooks in bed and podcasts and things like that, because your attention is away from the rumination. It's not distracting. You're not suppressing. In the day, practice with the rumination. Maybe get therapy, and then just change up your routine at night and keep your attention external. You'll drop off.
That must be one, isn't it? That last one, changing your routines up. That must be a big, even if it's going for a walk late at night.
Yeah, just habits. There's
something different, yeah.
Yeah, we're creatures of habit. Like, everything's a habit. I say that to my clients. I mean, think about all your automatic habits. I shower the same way. I brush my teeth the same way. I drive the same way. I'm like on autopilot, completely on autopilot. I make tea the same way. It's so many things on autopilot, which is good.
Yeah.
But then sometimes some sneaky habits getting in there that they're not helpful.
Just before we end, Josh, I want to quickly go back, if we can, to the panic attacks. Because for anyone watching or listening that might be close to that, because there will be some people that don't know it's coming and almost feel like it might be coming. Are there any sort of obvious sort of triggers that, okay, maybe you are about to have a panic attack? Is it just something that, for want of a better phrase, you just have to have? It's just going to happen.
It's going to, don't fight it, because it cannot hurt you. It feels like it is. If you're having specific panic attacks in relation to certain triggers, that can actually be a sign of trauma and PTSD. So if you have a panic attack when you see a certain person or someone who looks like a certain person, if you're having panic attacks because of stuff that, you know, that reminds you of some bad things that happened in your childhood, maybe it could be certain smells, sounds, whatever. For me, it was like it was a song when I was growing up, and I heard a song and I would just go into a panic attack because of some traumatic events. Then definitely you need help with PTSD. You cannot do that on your own. There's no shame in that. And PTSD isn't just, you know, returning from the trenches. It's a very common thing. But the vast majority of panic attacks are not that. If you can feel a panic attack coming along, you just got to ride it out. You can't stop it. Don't resist it. It will last probably 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes. Most people can't see it. It's not like on Netflix, you know, where they're rolling around on the floor, dissociating. That's not, most panic attacks, they don't occur like that. You can have a panic. I've had panic attacks, full-on panic attacks, in a room full of people and no one's noticed.
So inwardly.
What? Really?
The vast majority of panic.
I thought it was all brown paper bags and that.
Nope, that's a myth. It's and that doesn't really work either. But it's a myth.
That's malicious, isn't it? That's what, that would have been the first. If someone told me they were having a panic attack, I'd go scrambling for a brown paper bag, yeah.
Yeah, well, the ambulance staff used to do that up until, like, what, 5-6 years ago. And realised, no, you don't need to do anything. It's not hurting you, so why are you reacting to it? As soon as you react to it, you're teaching the brain that the panic attack itself is dangerous. So the next time you're going to go out and you'll be like, oh, I hope I don't have a panic attack when I do my podcast. I hope I don't have a panic attack at the gig. I hope I don't have a panic attack. No, just be like, I recovered when I said, I don't really care if I have one. I'd rather not. Yeah. It's not nice, but I don't care if I have one. And I practiced just panicking and realized it's just an adrenaline rush. That's all it is. A panic attack is just a confusion around why you're having so much adrenaline. So yeah, just let it on. This is just an adrenaline rush.
This Josh, has been amazing.
It has been.
This has genuinely been, this is possibly, if not definitely, my favourite episode. Thank you, Josh.
Well, that's a big shout. Fatherhood was really good.
This is definitely top but two. I had to deal with you for the whole of that without anybody else.
Every other guest now is going to be like, one second, emailing in, one second, wasn't
Josh, I found it educational, I found it interesting. I think you've been so articulate and honest. I've really enjoyed this one. Thank you so much, mate.
Oh, thank you very much.
Josh, just before you go, how can people get in touch?
So I'm Anxiety Josh on social media. That's where I do most of my stuff. My page is on Instagram. I use quite a lot. Yeah, it's just type in Anxiety Josh, Joshua Fletcher, my face pops up and you can have a look. There's loads of resources there, loads of free resources as well. And if you know, if you're a bit like that sounds a bit more about what I'm about, you know, go listen to that. That's cool.
Josh, really appreciate it. It's been a good one, right? Anxiety. Hopefully we have educated, I say we, Josh has educated you a bit on anxiety. It's been a really good Men's Room podcast, this one. Make sure you download all the podcasts from wherever you get your podcasts from. And as always say this, if you prefer to watch this, as I always do with my podcast, make sure you head over to TalkSport's YouTube channel where you can watch the podcast as well. From myself, from Rory, from Josh, thank you very much.
ToolStation are the proud sponsors of the Men's Room podcast on TalkSport. Join the ToolStation Club today online, in-store or via the app, and you will save some money getting a 5% discount shopping with ToolStation, as well as a chance to get your hands on some fantastic prizes such as TVs, gaming consoles and even holidays. If all that isn't enough, then remember, if you sign up, then you will get loads of exclusive discounts that aren't available anywhere else. That's the ToolStation Club, so make sure you join today, online, in-store, or via the app.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.